Okay, June 24th. Wow, June 24th, 2025. And Tuesday, as usual. Welcome, everyone. We will start with the period of meditation in the traditional manner. I will give some instruction as well as giving you some quiet time. Just settling in to your posture, however you like to hold your body when you meditate. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Coming into stillness and feeling the body at rest. Sensations and energies, pleasant or unpleasant, neutral, the life of the body. Brought into awareness. And the breath moving easily, rhythmically in the body. Breathing in. Breathing out. Just letting the breath calm the body, calm the feeling realm. It's a sense of letting go. Releasing into the present moment. Just this. Feeling the sensations of breath. That's a focal point so that the mind can settle as well. The breath has no words connected to it, just sensation. So when we let those sensations fill the attention, and there's no busyness, not so much language coming through. And then we might notice thoughts ought to capture the attention again. And let that go and come back, just back to the body and the breath. Very simple. Nothing special. There may be some mood or emotion present, but we don't have to create a story or try to fix anything. Just feel, just be present with the experience, openness, acceptance. Such a tendency of the mind to try to control our experience, our mind states, our feelings. And here we let go of that habitual behavior. See what it's like to just allow feelings to be there, sensations, thoughts to come and go. No need to take control or fix things. Allowing for imperfection. Just aware that I've not been giving a lot of the meditation instruction that was particularly cryptic. And I know people are at different stages of practice, and there's a it can be really useful to have very specific guidance. I have kind of drifted away from giving very structured meditation instructions, and I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not. It's just, one sort of evolves in their teaching style, I suppose. When I started to practice meditation, particularly, well, I started with TM, which is again very specific. You just repeat your mantra, and when your mind slips, you come back to your mantra. When I started to practice Vipassana meditation, there were first, I guess, taught the noting practice, and here you're kind of talking to yourself continuously in that form, and at that point, I found that really useful because I didn't know what to do with my mind. I wanted to have something to do with it, because otherwise, it just seemed to be unruly and out of control. And so, the noting practice, starts with just saying to yourself in out with your breath. And then when your mind wanders, you can and you realize you're thinking, you can just make a mental note of thinking, and then you come back to your breath. It starts to get more complicated, has more content when you start to note in more specific ways. And again, this can be very useful. You start to note, for instance, the type of thought that you're having. And there's a couple different ways to do this. One is to just sort of try to say, oh, that's a thought of planning, or that's a thought of anger, or that's a thought of remembering. And that can be, revealing to see. I mean, I found that useful because it really revealed to me what my habitual thinking was. I don't know if I've mentioned, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this once or twice, but like a few years ago, I realized that when I'm planning a trip, or when I'm looking forward to a trip, that I start planning, like I start packing the suitcase a couple weeks beforehand. And like literally like thinking, oh, figuring out what clothes I'm going to take, even though it's like weeks away. And of course, that's a expression of anxiety, right? You're trying to control the future through your planning, through that having all these details in order. But it's also revealing how little control we do have, because if all I can control is what I put in my suitcase, there's a lot of other things that are going to happen that I don't have control over. But it's kind of like just focus on that thing that you feel like you can control. So that kind of noting or observing the content of the mind can be personally revealing, and is call it like, a personal insight rather than sort of the more universal insight of impermanence or not self or unsatisfactoriness, the three characteristics. But so let me go back then. So another method that I learned early on, Another noting method was to simply note if things were, if there was a quality of wanting or a quality of aversion, so desire and aversion, whether your thought had one of those qualities. And those are the first two of the five hindrances: desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, doubt. But they're also, implicated in dukkha, in suffering. The second noble truth is saying, what grasping and aversion are the things that cause suffering. So it can be useful to just note this quality of the mind. So this is stepping out somewhat of the personal. It's more just seeing these categories of thought, types of thought, rather than, oh, I am thinking about this, or I am thinking about that, or I have these habits. It's just seeing that the mind is really caught in repetitive efforts to or repetitive striving, which manifests either as wanting or not wanting, or desire and aversion. And I found that very revealing, to just sit and start with the breath, and then when there's a thought, just could I see very quickly? And you don't have to think about it, because it's very clear when you have a thought. At least I found it clear, pretty clear quickly, that, oh, that was. And sometimes it takes a little moment, like, oh, I was, thinking about packing the suitcase. That's a desire to control. And after a while, you start to see that even those, what you define as desire, can have an aversive quality, or what you define as aversive can be a desire. So that there isn't really any difference, which is why I define that as wanting things to be different from the way they are. So either wanting, grasping at pleasure, or pushing displeasure away, just wanting things to be different from the way they are. But again, this kind of noting puts a structure on your meditation. So when there's this feeling of chaos in the mind, shall we say, or if you're not comfortable with the kind of formlessness of the mind, which is somewhat disturbing, until we get, sort of more familiar with it. This is a way of not just developing insight, which it certainly has that value, but also giving you something to do while you're sitting there. Because it can be hard to just, especially as when you begin to practice. I certainly felt this, like I wanted to sit for long periods of time. I wanted to sit for 45 minutes. But it was really hard for me to just like sit there and do nothing. It wasn't exactly boredom. It was just like, I don't even know how to define it. I think that probably anxiety is probably the best term, like not having any sort of structure can be very difficult. So these noting practices, I think, are quite useful in this regard, where they the limitations of their value can sort of, you start to see those limitations when, oh, how do I put it? It at a certain point, it can feel like busy making, and like just keeping yourself busy. And my experience with this really was on retreat, where what happened was I realized that there was a lot of grasping in the way I was practicing that way. So this is the risk, I think, that the noting practice becomes a form of grasping, and it becomes that when we're using it as an, when our effort is kind of about control And well, part of it is that there's this striving, and behind the practice is this wish for things to just stop. And so there's this, I think I had this idea that if I kept noting things, after a while they would stop bothering me, they would stop happening, that somehow things would quiet down. But it began to feel as if the noting was actually stirring things up in a way, that because I was constantly naming things and using language to name what was going on in the mind, it kept the flow of thinking going in a way. So at a certain point, I just dropped that form, that like noting, cutting things up into, naming things what they are, what is happening. And it was more like stepping back, just going, I'm just sitting here in the space of mind. Now, when I've had this first had this experience, it was on retreat, so my mind was already somewhat primed to settle. It was already settled to some extent, and as I say, I think the noting was unsettling it in a way. So at that point, I started to realize that, oh, the noting can become a kind of obsessiveness that creates more unhelpful energy. And I began to trust that I was okay to sit in this less structured form. And so that became sort of more of my practice. But the risk in that is that the sitting in the space of mind becomes spacey. And it, so these there is no perfect single form of meditation. And I'm not really describing that sitting in space of mind particularly. There isn't that much to describe in a way. But the point is that we can sort of have this idea that what I need to do is find the right way to meditate, and that when I find that, then I'm going to have the experience that I want to have in my meditation. And so you can see that in that kind of thinking, it's about control and it's about self, it's about ego. Because part of it is like, I'm going to be a good meditator, but it's also pleasure seeking, right? It'll be pleasant, it'll be blissful, and projecting what this is going to be. And at a certain point, I mean, we need to recognize that there isn't a place that we're arriving at with our meditation. We're always just passing through, and wherever we are is where we are. We can influence that moment. We can influence this moment and the next moment with with our effort, but we can't control it. And so there's this delicate balance between wise effort and letting go. And this is, I think, the heart of meditation in practical terms, in terms of technique, is balancing effort with letting go. And so going back to these forms, and there are many forms, and I've only talked about a couple of them, but there's forms like loving kindness meditation, repeating phrases, there's counting breaths, there's repeating mantras. And these can all be useful. And then there are things that are more formless, but even have guidance. So Joseph Goldstein's meditation called Big Mind has guidance, but it's more of a formless meditation, if that is possible. It's blending the two, I suppose. But I think that in terms of becoming a skilled meditator, we want to learn forms and then start to observe how the cause and effect with different forms and the states that respond to different forms. So if there's anxiety, what meditation, what form of meditation helps with that? If there's sadness, if there's elation, and just recognizing, oh, right, today I'm in a very easeful place. I don't have to make a lot of effort. Oh, and the next day, oh, I'm in a different place. I'm very distracted. I need to really pull the mind together, do something that'll really ground me a bit. And so we learn these techniques, but then we have to be this kind of observer of ourselves, and watch this cause and effect relationship within the meditative experience. And it's there's always a kind of a way in which we're always trying to fix the last problem, that. Just as we're solving, one issue, something else happens, and maybe that's a little bit negative or something. But I guess the point being that it's again that we're not going to perfect this process, and that's where the letting go comes in, is recognizing that I can't control these mind states continuously. Sometimes things are going to get really pleasant and really settled, and I'm involved in that happening, but I'm not in control of that happening. And then sometimes things are going to be very agitated and disturbed, and I can work with that. One of the keys then, and this is something I talk about a fair amount, which is how do you react to the what's happening in the mind and in the body? What so and this is where, and this kind of goes back to some of the other things I was saying, that when we start to practice, if we have this ideal in mind, then we're kind of almost continuously in conflict with what's going on. We don't want things to be the way they are, right? We want things to be different from the way they are. And then we're adding in, if we're trying to attain something in our meditation, we're adding in this judgment about what's happening. So not only is the mind maybe busy or caught up in, packing the suitcase, but we're also thinking, I shouldn't be packing my suitcase. What's wrong with me? I'm not traveling for 2 weeks. I'm doing this wrong, or I'm bad at this, or whatever, whatever the story is. And it's that second thing, which is really the second arrow, right? That we really do have some influence over. And that's rather than trying to control the sort of primary aspect of meditation, like where's your mind at? And what's going on with your mind? If you can control the secondary aspect, the reactivity to the mind state, then you're in a much more pleasant place. And actually, I think that has the most positive impact in terms of generating calm, because what creates disturbance in the mind is that secondary mental reaction to the experience. When so this goes back to the classic, acceptance is the answer to my problems today from the AA Big Book. when we can just accept, oh, this is the state I'm in, then that acceptance inclines things toward calm, inclines things towards equanimity. Acceptance and equanimity are kind of the parallels in, if acceptance is kind of the 12th step of recovery idea, equanimity is the Buddhist idea for this same state, which is this non-reactive state, not trying to control things, letting go. So this is, for me, the way to peace in meditation. It's the way to peace in meditation isn't discovering the perfect meditative form, learning the magical mantra, but it's rather watching the reactivity and seeing if you can let go of the reactivity to the states that are arising. And that of course, there's a lot of mindfulness that needs to be there for all of this. There needs to be mindfulness to see the states that are arising. And then there needs to be mindfulness, especially to see the reactivity to the states. And then the application of effort, the effort is the effort to let go, which is, again, one of the paradoxes of Buddhist meditation. Letting go being something that seems about not making an effort, and yet it requires an engagement, and it requires us to learn what that means and how that works, how that feels. And again, we can only do this through repetitive practice. I say again because it's just a comment I often make, that we learn how to meditate by meditating over and over and over and watching these different states, these different reactive states. And we start to recognize them, and this becomes, I mean, we have the kind of contemporary brain science of meditation, the creating neural pathways. But those neural pathways, aren't just above your neck. They're not just in your brain. The neural pathways are very much in your body, so that we feel the letting go. We sense the letting go. And the letting go sometimes starts with the body, by relaxing the body. And sometimes just taking, and this is why the breath is so inherent to meditation, that we breathe. And the breath itself, the exhalation, that can be used as this calming device, and the body releases tension that then, interacts with, I don't know if it even separate from, to say, interacts with the mind, but it affects the mental activity. So some thoughts on meditation. And maybe open it up a little bit. It looks like Monica got very busy. You got very busy with the links here. So, well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say, there's only a few in there. I was seeing them pop up. We got the five hindrances, very good. The second arrow, Sutta, and oh, the Dalai Lama. Ooh, okay, great. Anyway, comments, questions, Gabrielle, hello.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for this really interesting discussion about meditation. I finally bought your book, and I'm only on the third step, but I'm really, really loving what you're doing. And what you talked about this morning goes very beautifully with it. The thing that I'm blessed enough to have many, many years of sobriety. But I struggle now with the balance between being in the moment and identifying as that drunk that I once was and that addict that I once was, that I still am. But I realize that by characterizing myself as that, I often am filled with shame and loathing. In the moment, I'm not that person. And so there's that disruption kind of in my balance and effort with meditation and alcoholism and addiction. Thanks.
Great topic. Another, we could take this as the next next theme. And it does, I appreciate that you are kind of making that connection between, we could say, between form and formlessness. That is, I'm an alcoholic, or there is no self. And this is the sort of paradox of recovery as well. And I've actually I've been listening to and reading Ajahn Amaro with his book The Island, and he's very interested in and focuses a lot on identity and ego and how we create self. And and this is one of the objections. People who come to AA who have a Buddhist background, or maybe not even, but that they don't want to take on this identity of alcoholic. And first of all, I view that as a useful tool, as a reminder that I don't and can't drink. But understanding that identity, as we ordinarily characterize it, is just a functional creation of the mind. It's not a real thing. I mean, I find this. I don't find this easy myself. I kind of had a spate of regret going on for a couple of weeks when my past kind of came back to me in a haunting way. I mean, it's easy to say and to sort of give these glib Buddhist answers, oh, that's all in the past, and that's, there is no self and all that. But memory is memory, and regret and feelings are real things. And at the end of the day, it's somewhat like the way I approach meditation, which is that, I'm a human being who's made mistakes, and that's what human beings do. So I am going to live with a certain amount of pain about the past, and that's not always what I did. Sometimes it's what other people did to me, right? Like, aging requires the experience of pain, of loss. In fact, the more aging, the more loss. I was talking to my 87-year-old brother the other day, and he just sort of said offhandedly, "Well, all my friends are dead now, you know." And it was like, "Yeah, okay. How do we paint that with flowers and, smiley faces?" It's like, to me, I don't know, to me, whatever. I don't even love that expression. I hear myself say it a lot. But one of my thoughts is that aging happily requires the ability to hold the wounds of life and the loss of life in a careful way, to be able to absorb it and take it and not be overwhelmed by it. And because there's a lot of old bitter people, a lot of old angry people, a lot of old sad people. And I think that because of all that life pummels you with. I mean, it's easy when you're young to be like, oh yeah, everything's cool, to be sort of lighthearted. But You go through, and this is a group of people here who've been through stuff, every one of you. And just learning to live with that and to hold those wounds, I think is it's kind of the art of aging happily, So that's a really general statement, but yeah, it's kind of what comes up when you bring that up. We got some other hands up, so let me move on with lots more wisdom. Holly, hello.
This is kind of a different topic, but
Good.
something that I struggle with quite a bit. I'm from Oregon. I come at this from the Al-Anon and food addiction side of things. But I have this big problem with the cultural appropriation thing within Buddhism. And, when I go to some ceremony or some chant or something like that, I feel all this uneasiness about it. And I'm wondering, I think that comes up for other people. And so I'm wondering what you have to think, what you think about it.
Well,
Thank you.
yeah, certainly a serious topic, and I will say that I don't think a lot about it, and not because I don't think it's important, but it's not where I put a lot of focus on it. I guess what's important to me is what's the what are we doing here? What are we, what are we, how are we using these things? And what is our, attitude toward them? Like there can be a lot of performative sort of spirituality, where you're, wearing the right outfit and chanting the right words and kind of putting on a smiley Buddhist face all the time, and so that when it's ego, when there's ego behind it, I see it as destructive. The question of, I mean, there's a lot of different, discussions of this. The mindfulness movement, as separate from Buddhism, is sometimes criticized for this, for sort of taking this Asian tradition and not just sort of mechanizing it, but also commercializing it. The when people are sincerely, I mean, for me, the Dharma is this just this precious teaching, and it's natural that in a different culture, when we encounter some teaching from a different culture, when two cultures meet, that we're going to adapt it to our own culture. Now, whether that's appropriation or not, I mean, I don't, I guess I'm saying I don't see it as damaging or unwholesome or
Not,
unethical.
it's not necessarily the ideas and the concepts and the teachings and even being in a sangha and all that. It's more just the those ritual things that I don't know. I don't know how to think about that.
No, I mean, that's where what I'm calling the performative aspects of it. And it's kind of the, namaste culture, which, like, I'm sorry, but namaste is Sanskrit and it's not something that Buddhists say. So when people say namaste to me, I'm like, I don't know why you're saying that to me. You went to a yoga class, but it's not what I'm doing. So bless you. The thing is, I pay attention to, I love the monastic community, right? But I'm not into their rituals, and theirs are very authentic,
Oh yeah.
right? But I'm just
Absolutely.
not drawn to that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Thanks.
yeah, I'm sorry. I can't say anymore.
No, that's
Useful.
good. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Holly. Aaron, hello.
Good morning. I hope
Morning.
everyone is doing well. I have a question about sponsorship, both in AA and in 12-step recovery, what we're doing right now. As I said last week, I had to fire my sponsor because she disagreed with my path. It was not correct. I needed to be going to more AA meetings. Meditation, I needed to stop doing as much and work on, she said that, and work on other steps as well. And yeah, I mean, basically, meditation was not the answer to sobriety. I need X number of meetings. For her, it was three. What are your thoughts as
I'm not your sponsor. And I'm not going
well,
to sponsor you.
no, yeah, you are kind of, but I just want what it, oh, no, go ahead, say what you were going to say, just answer her if you can.
Well, I mean, my sponsor once told me I overemphasized the 11th step, but what can I say? It's like it became my job. So, I think sponsors should stay out of their sponsees' spiritual business. The steps say God as we understood him, and that it's very clear that throughout the literature that any spiritual path it is valid as long as it's wholesome and founded in moral principles. The idea that there's some magical number of meetings that's going to protect you from relapse is magical thinking. There's no number of meetings that will protect you from relapse. There's no step that's going to protect you from relapse. This is more than that. And maybe less than that, just to be really annoying about it. But we do that there again. We have to again. I say this because all of this talk today is sort of about the middle way. We have to find a balance between our own intuition and the words of others, and we try to find people that we trust so that we can. If we are behaving or making decisions that might be risky, and someone that we trust says maybe don't do that or maybe try something else, that we listen to them. But when people tell you that you're going to drink because you meditate too much or whatever, it's just like there's no cause and effect there, and for me, the 11th step is the gateway into my step work. When I meditate, I recognize my powerlessness over my mind. I see my mind. I take my inventory. I see the unwholesome stuff. I become very attuned to that. I see things that I need to make amends for. All the steps really are there. There's a lot of letting go, turning it over. So I've never seen the 11th step as this, like, oh, just this separate thing that sits over here that's like, the medicine that I take. Well, and then there's all the steps. For me, the 11th step works in a much more pervasive way. And, that's just, that's how it's worked out for me. I also think that if you're newer in recovery, as I don't know how long you've been sober, I can't quite remember. Yeah. Then it's not, unwise to stay very close to the program, and three meetings a week isn't a lot, frankly. So I don't think that's bad advice. The telling you not to meditate so much, it's sort of silly. So, take what's useful, but we do have to watch out for our ego, and what, and it's easy when someone tells us what to do and we don't want to do it to like, go in the opposite direction out of resentment, and that sort of. So take care of yourself. But I think after you've got 10 years sober, you can be more self-led, self-sponsored. But 1 year, it's a good idea to have somebody watching over your shoulder a little bit. So yes, I'm now your sponsor, and you need to go to three meetings a week. So that's, there we go.
Thank you so much. Oh, by the way, the other part of it was in this 12-step recovery that we're doing, Buddhist 12-step recovery, do people have sponsors or rely on
Didn't we talk about this last week? Maybe you weren't here. That
no,
we
but
have. That we have this sheet,
oh
a
yes.
Google, yeah. So you can find somebody maybe on there who will guide you. I don't. This isn't a program. This is me having a Zoom class. So I don't. I have not invented a Buddhist recovery program. That's separate from anything else.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Aaron, thanks.
Namaste.
Yeah.
Sorry.
All right, folks. Nice to see everyone.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, what you're doing helps a lot.
Okay, thank you. Even when I'm not in a good mood.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't
Okay, that's more like it.
All right.
How can you tell? I'm so, I never reveal my emotions, so how would anybody know if I was in a good mood or a bad mood? I'm so serene. Okay, never mind.
All right. Enjoy your day.
As soon as the class, as soon as you get on Zoom, you're like, uh-oh, Kevin's in. All right, you guys. Nice to see everybody. Thanks for hanging out, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you,
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you.
Don't start any
Good week.
unnecessary wars. Sorry, just thought I'd throw that in.
Take good
Bye.
care.
All right, Mike, nice to see you.